Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Claire Parkinson. I'm Professor of Culture, Communication and Screen Studies and co-director of the Centre for Human Animal Studies at Edgehill University.
fantastic to have you with us today, Claire. Thank you so much. And my opening gambit, as is usually the case, is to inquire what's currently dynamizing, interesting, preoccupying, retarding you.
Okay, huge question, and I guess I'm going to give you a really short answer to start off with because
Okay.
I suppose generally, what's occupying me, I'm going to put it that way, is thinking about what people do to, with, and for animals, and I suppose where my work sits, it's sort of at that intersection between cultural studies, media studies, and human animal studies. So it's a lot of things that happen within that framework. So a lot of my work is particularly concerned recently. It's been particularly concerned with something that's been happening in the UK, which is the inclusion of the XL bully into the list of banned breeds. And that's something, it's work that I've been doing, it's research that I've been doing, which has been looking at government legislation. And in the UK, the legislation is the Dangerous Dogs Act, which was introduced in 1991. And a lot of the work that I've been doing, and it traces back probably, I don't know, the early 2000s, has been looking at the kind of the media and cultural aspects of the introduction of that particular piece of legislation. And it's come to the fore again now with the inclusion of a type of dog known as the XL bully, which has now been included in that ban. So that's something that I've been doing more work on recently, which is around, I did a big study on public perceptions of dangerous dogs, and just published a piece which is a historical piece which looks at connections between masculinity, dog breeds, and dog fighting as well in the UK. I guess the other thing that's probably on my mind a little bit, and you'll know about this, Toby, is a new book that's coming out. Quick plug, I guess, here. A
Yes.
new book that's coming out in July, which is called Animal Activism On and Off Screen, which is being published by Sydney University Press. I'm a co-editor. My other co-editor is the incredibly talented and wonderful Lara Herring from University of Salford. And Toby, you have a chapter in the book, and thank you so much for that. A wonderful chapter from Pamela Anderson and Peter. So thank you so much for contributing to that. So that's coming out in July. So they're the things that are occupying me at this very moment in time. But I've been doing quite a lot of work around the dangerous dogs issue, which is ongoing, but something that's become much more focused over the last few months or so.
I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that in the context for listeners outside Britain who form the majority of the listenership. Worth knowing that the British like to regard themselves as animal lovers, specifically as dog lovers. This is a part of national mythology. I wonder if you could share with us a little bit about the genesis of this Dangerous Dogs Act from over 30 years ago and the issue you raised of both people's perceptions of danger with dogs and this latest classification in the context of your study into masculinity and fighting dogs.
So the background to this is, and actually I have been involved with work on this prior to coming into academia. I was actually involved in some of the campaigns against introducing this piece of legislation originally, which was back in 1991. So In 1991, and I'm going to say spurred on by a lot of media interest, particularly from popular news, a lot of media interest in dog attacks. The government at the time felt compelled to respond by introducing some legislation. At the time, there were a lot of news stories about dog attacks, particularly dog attacks by, it was Rottweilers, German Shepherd dogs, also known as Alsatians at that time, but now known as German Shepherd dogs, and Pit Bull Terriers, American Pit Bull Terriers that had been quite recently introduced into the UK. And alongside that, there was also a focus on the growth of dog fighting in the UK. So, according to, if you like, the more formal channels, you'll be told that, well, dog fighting just didn't there was no dog fighting in the UK, and there hadn't been for many years. And it was something that was just, sort of aligned with the introduction of the American Pit Bull Terrier. This is, we know, is not true. There was dog fighting. There was dog fighting throughout the 20th century. But the first prosecution for dog fighting was in the early 1980s. And so there were a lot of things happening in the UK at that time. There were, alongside the increase, there was certainly an increase in dog fighting. There was increased media attention in dog attacks on people, particularly vulnerable people, children and older people. And there were a lot of concerns about young men at that time, and particularly unemployed youth. And the concerns really revolved around, I mean, we have to set this again within the sort of broader context and consider that there was incredibly high unemployment. There was, we'd had the impact of a recession as well. There were a whole group, if you like, of factors that kind of came together. And I suppose at that time as well, 1980s, early 1980s, when the concerns really start to be raised, there's questions about, I'm going to say more broadly, around masculinity and challenges to ideas around, what constitutes, a real man. And obviously this is in light of a lot of heavy industry disappearing in the UK, and questions about, what was the man's role. Obviously women were increasingly, they were getting, there was a shift in terms of women's rights. It was, it's a slow shift and we're still not there, but there was a shift in terms of women's rights as well at that time. So we have this real mix, I would say, of factors. And this starts to come together alongside concerns about increase in drug culture in the UK. And it seems to start to coalesce around these questions of dog ownership, and particularly about who owns dogs such as American Pit Bull Terriers. So you start to see quite a lot of articles in the press from the mid-80s onwards, which are about dog fighting being connected to young men and unemployed young men, particularly to drug culture. And then alongside that, an increased number of dog attacks. We also have to recognize that at the time there was a huge increase in dog ownership. So during the 1980s, we saw a massive sort of increase in the number of dogs and pet dogs. And again, there were concerns about these dogs were not being properly controlled. They were, supposedly out and, free roaming or straying, as some people would say. So all of these things, as I say, kind of came together into a group of concerns that seemed to become focused around problems related to dogs and dog breeds, particularly, as I say, the American Pit Bull Terrier, but also other breeds were sort of implicated, particularly around dog attacks. So we get to a point in 1991 where The government feel that the media pressure, which they admit it was the media pressure as well as the public pressure, but specifically the media pressure, forces them into a response. And that response is to introduce what we call breed-specific legislation, which is legislation that prohibits the breeding, ownership, or exchange of particular breeds or types of dog. And at the time, it was very, very clear that this was very much a class-based response, because the MPs who were responsible for introducing this piece of legislation, the Secretary of State at the time, Kenneth Baker, he actually said, well, I'm paraphrasing here, but he said along the lines of, well, we can ban the pit bull because pit bull owners, are covered in tattoos and wear earrings, but we can't upset what he called the Green Welly Brigade. Now, for people who don't know what the Green Welly Brigade is, it just refers to a particular type of middle class person, but particularly people who would be interested in countryside pursuits, but certainly middle and upper middle classes. So he says in a statement which is published actually in his autobiography, that he couldn't upset the Green Welly Brigade. So he could upset the people who owned American Pit Bull Terriers. And so what we have as a result of this is, even though he admits that there were more at that time German Shepherd dogs that were involved in dog bite incidents, he didn't dare ban German Shepherds because of the type of people who, in his, as far as he was concerned, owned those dogs. So what we end up with is we end up with a piece of legislation that is introduced that bans American Pit Bull Terriers and three other types of dog or breeds of dog, which actually weren't really in the UK at that time. And this piece of legislation was and it was revised slightly in 1997, because prior to that, any dog that was there was a period where you could register your dog as an American Pit Bull Terrier, and if you didn't, after that time, the dogs were just automatically euthanized. So if they were identified as American Pit Bull Terriers, they were euthanized. Now, one of the big problems with this idea of identifying an American Pit Bull Terrier is that they are not a breed as such; they are a type of dog, and so where we might have specific breeds which we can easily identify, it's actually very difficult to identify an American Pit Bull Terrier. So the UK government decided that they would refer to a 1977 article that had been written in I think it was the American Pit Bull Gazette, which described what a fighting dog, the ideal fighting dog, would look like. And they took the measurements from that. And those were the measurements that they still continue to use today to identify Pit Bull Terriers. What this has resulted in is a lot of dogs who are seized by police, who are seized just because of how they look. This has got nothing to do with their behavior. It's purely because they fit a particular style or look, and then set of measurements. So then they're taken, the dogs are assessed, and if they fit the set of measurements, then they are determined to be Pit Bull Terriers. And for anybody who knows anything about dogs, and certainly anything about dogs and the legislation in the UK, for example, if you cross a Labrador with a Staffordshire Bull Terrier, you will quite likely, in a litter of puppies, have a dog that will fit the description in the UK of an American Pit Bull Terrier. So what this means is that we in this country now are prosecuting people. It's a criminal offence to own one of these dogs. So people are being prosecuted, and the dogs are often seized. They're held for long periods of time while these cases come to court, which is obviously very bad for the dog's welfare. And then What happens as a result is that they will be determined one way or another, whether nowadays they're not automatically euthanized. They can sometimes, they're allowed to go back home to their owners, but usually after a protracted period being held. The owners of the dogs are not allowed to see the dogs or know where they are. They're taken away and kept in secret police kennels. And this can take, anything from 3 months up to a year, maybe more than a year, while these dogs are being held while the cases come to court. Aside from the problems that this obviously has in terms of animal welfare, the cost of actually administering this piece of ridiculous legislation, and I will say it's ridiculous legislation, is huge. And since it was introduced in 1991, you would expect, because it was introduced to protect the public from dog attacks, you would expect that the number of dog attacks would reduce. It hasn't. It has increased year on year since 1991. So I think the most recent numbers that we have were from 2022, and we have over 25,000 incidents, dog bite incidents or dog attack incidents, which have resulted in hospital, in people needing to go to hospital. What happened more recently was that, again, there was a lot of media noise around some dog attacks. Unfortunately, we've had a series of fatalities in the UK. People have died as a result of dog attacks, and a number of these attacks have been blamed on a type of dog called the XL bully. Well, we know that, obviously, again, we've got another breed of or another type of dog, which is not actually a breed. It doesn't have a set of sort of predetermined characteristics. So it's very difficult for people to say whether these attacks have or haven't been due to, due to the dog's type. But what we do know is that the Dangerous Dogs Act doesn't work. We've seen no reduction in dog bites. But again, the UK government were felt compelled to do something about, again, the media pressure to respond to these fatalities. And so what they did was just to add the XL bully onto the list of banned breeds. And so that came in very recently, at the beginning of this year. And so this has resulted in, again, some fairly horrendous cases. I mean, we've seen now the number of XL bully or bully type dogs, bully breed type dogs, the number being abandoned has just shot up. I don't have any recent numbers, but it's, rescues are reporting that these dogs are just being abandoned in very, very large numbers. There's a number of dogs that, again, have, sadly, people have felt, compelled not only to abandon them to rescues, but just to throw them out on the streets. There's been a number of cases now because people who live in social housing, a lot of their contract will state that they're not allowed to own a banned breed. So many people have been put in a situation of either losing their house or euthanizing their dog. So you can imagine that's been dreadful for people. There has been an opportunity for people to register their XL bullies on an exempt a register of exemption. However, the cost of that again has been prohibitive because not only do you have to register the dogs, you also then have to have them neutered within a particular time frame. They have to be insured. And they always have to be muzzled and leashed in any public place. So you're not allowed to let them off a lead anymore or let them exercise. So, in a public space. So it's been very, very difficult for a lot of people, but many people have been concerned because, once again, the guidance on what an XL bully is incredibly vague, the same as it was with the American Pit Bull Terrier. And so there are a lot of people who've probably registered dogs or tried to exempt dogs that actually are not XL bullies at all. But the guidance that's out there that the government have produced has been very, very poor. But what's consistent with this is that what we've seen is, if we'd like to phrase it in this way, we've seen a moral panic around the particular types of dogs, but not just the types of dogs, it's their owners as well. That's the kind of this link that's often made. Who are the people that would own a type of dog like this? There's always this question of what type of person would possibly want to own, this type of dog. And a lot of it is certainly, I would say, a continuation of the class politics that were absolutely present back in 1991, and I think we're still seeing that again now. So my interest has been twofold. First of all, I in 2021, this was with a couple of amazing people who work with me on this project. Which was I should say Laura Herring and David Gould. We worked together on a project which looked at public perceptions of dangerous dogs. We looked at the extent to which media does intervene in people's understanding of dangerous dogs, and you won't be surprised to find out that, of course, it intervenes, and of course, it shapes and influences how people think about what a dangerous dog is.
And Prof. Clevis wouldn't be the Daily Express, the Daily Mail, and the Sun by any chance, would it?
Yes, you're absolutely right. How could you possibly guess? Yes, absolutely. We did this piece of work. It was actually more than this. We looked at a lot more than just the kind of the media question. Although what was very interesting was we asked people where they got their information from about dogs and about dangerous dogs. And it's actually primarily through television and through television programs. We were expecting it to be online, but actually it was through TV, which was that was a surprise to us and to the team. We hadn't expected that. But we also asked people. We worked with an amazing project consultant who's an expert in dog behavior. And what one of the things that we looked at was whether people are able to read dog body language. And it was interesting. We had over 1,500 people who responded to this particular survey that we did, and we found that they were incredibly confident about their ability to read dog body language, and actually incredibly poor at reading dog body language. So obviously there's something really interesting that's happening at the moment in terms of dogs are trying to communicate with us and tell us, I'm not happy, I don't like something. And actually, we don't seem to be listening. We don't seem to be, understanding what they're trying to say to us. So I think there's a big piece of work to be done there in better educating the public about how dogs are communicating, often very, very clearly, their unhappiness and their intention. And I think that this may be, I can't say for certain because obviously this is a piece of research, that's been done, which was specifically about understanding people's knowledge of and ability to read dog signals. But we have to look at the fact that we've got an increasing number of dog bites in the UK, dog bite incidents, and we can see that we have people who claim to be knowledgeable and understand dogs who actually are
Who
really
actually
struggling
don't.
to read dog
And
body language.
I guess a lot of, pardon me, I'm just making a cup of tea, which is, as you will know well, Professor Parkinson, the refuge of the standardless British person when confronted with uncomfortable realities of any kind. Almost all domestically focused movies in the world, in the set of, about, and especially during the Second World War, see people, whoever is playing John Mill's wife, or mother saying, I'll just go and put a cup of tea on.
Of course. And I think it's the mainstay of all sitcoms as well in sort of the 1970s. Oh, that's terrible. Let's make a cup of tea.
And in fact, but nowadays, unfortunately, people don't say a cup of char, which was what I was brought up on. Cup of char. In any event, I mean, getting on to the activist part of this, Prof, you said that you were involved in activism way back in 91. when this, I think you said that, when this bizarre legislation was taking form. And I wonder if you could perhaps talk a wee bit about the intersection of activism and scholarship, because on the one hand, faculty are constantly told to do things that are relevant, but that doesn't seem to be bad when it's building a dam or designing a freeway, but it seems to be lacking in credibility when it involves activism on behalf of animals, as opposed to activism on behalf of capital or the state. So I wondered if you could just reflect, in terms of your own experience, on this dynamic between undertaking research and being an activist.
I suppose that, I mean, just to say, I was involved in animal advocacy from being a teenager. So it's something that I would say has always been present, certainly throughout my whole adult life. When it comes to research and scholarship, I align myself with something called critical animal studies. And this is so there's the human animal studies, and what human animal studies does is it centers the animal. So the animals are no longer sort of on the periphery or marginalized. We talk about it as, the animal question or the animal turn. But critical animal studies is one particular, if you like, approach to the animal question. And where critical animal studies, I would say, is distinguished from maybe other types of scholarship which is involved in looking at animals, so animal studies or human animal studies, is that critical animal studies is very much grounded in an anti-speciesist stance. So critical animal studies has concerns about the material realities of animals' lives at its focus. So as critical animal studies scholars, we're concerned with the treatment of animals. And so it's interesting because I always think a lot of the critical animal studies work aligns very well with approaches in media and cultural studies because it's concerned with critiques of capitalism, with interconnecting systems of oppression, racism, sexism, other forms of ideological domination. So actually, critical animal studies aligns very well with a lot of the, as I say, the media and the cultural studies approaches. But most people who see themselves as critical animal studies scholars do also see themselves as activists, both in the sense that our work is part of our activism. So we're very much kind of embedded in this sort of praxis. And the, I mean, my own experience of being involved in this sort of work, I would say it's interesting because I started doing research into, let's say, animals before I even understood that animal studies was a thing. So for me, it was the end of the, or sort of, just the end of the 1990s when I sort of came. I sort of had a career working in another sector and came into academia, sort of the end of the 1990s. And this is where I really started kind of bringing my interest in animals in. And I was saying to people, why can't I do research on animals? And they were saying, well, that's ridiculous. Don't be so silly. Who would do research on animals? That's what scientists do. Scientists do research. And I say, no, from a cultural perspective, from a media perspective. And I was told, don't be so silly. That's ridiculous. Who would be interested in that? And I remember speaking to somebody at the time who was a very well-respected academic. And this would have been sort of, the sort of midpoint in the 1990s. And I said, I'm really interested. I wanted to sort of do some research on animals and animals and culture. And they said to me, if you can go to the library and find me one book that's on animals and culture, then I'd say to you, yes, go ahead and do it. And of course, I went to the library. I was looking around, and it was really difficult. And I couldn't find a, and I came back and I said, okay, fair enough. I found this stuff on philosophy, and he said that doesn't count. So,
Thing a
but
lot welcome.
Yes, I sort of persevered, and I published my first journal article that was specifically on animals and media. That was published in 2001, and I think it's been quite difficult at times, because certainly back, the beginning of the 2000s, end of the 1990s, if you were working in this area, it wasn't taken seriously. And so I, like a number of other people who were interested in this area, I developed two strands of work. So I actually developed the strand that was very, I would say, very traditional film studies. And then alongside that, I would do my animal work as well. And every now and again, I'd be fortunate because they could cross paths. But I had to maintain this work that was seen as credible. I think that that's changed considerably now. I mean, human animal studies, critical animal studies has grown. I think that, we've seen a real sea change, which is very, very welcome. And now it's, I mean, I can't even keep up with the number of conferences and the books that are coming out. I can remember at one time, on my bookshelves, there was sort of half a shelf of books, and that was everything in the field, everything that was in animal studies. And now, I mean, yeah, I would have to be a very, very wealthy person to try and keep up with buying all the books that come out. But I think we're so fortunate because we're seeing an amazing, new generation of scholars who are coming into critical animal studies and animal studies, and I think that's marvelous. And we're very fortunate. I'm co-director of the Centre for Human Animal Studies, and we're so fortunate. We have the most amazing PhD students, who, again, they're the next generation of scholars in the area, and it's so exciting to see their work and the fact now that it's a credible area, to look at. It's as I say, that's really heartening. But yeah, marvelous to just see that new generation of scholars coming through now, who are really forging like new paths, and critical animal studies has really taken off, which is marvelous. But as I say, it's interesting because critical animal studies draws together scholarship and, and activism, I think, in really interesting ways. But I'm surprised more people in media and cultural studies haven't become involved in critical animal studies, because, I see so many overlaps. It's surprising to me that more people aren't involved.
Well, Prof, one of your most important books on this topic, and you've written a great deal on it and on related issues, is one of these moments where one can bring together the stuff that you like doing, but that is in a sense required of you, versus the stuff that you love doing and you're committed to very deeply. And the book, if I can put those words into your mouth, as it were, and the book I'm thinking of is Animals, Anthropomorphism, and Mediated Encounters. It's got four of the best chapter titles I've ever encountered. When Animals Look, When Animals Feel, When Animals Speak, When Animals Think. As you know, one of the things that we're promised from artificial intelligence is telling us what our pussycats are trying to communicate to us. Why this should be promised, I have no idea. Because it seems to me that this is the last great communicative puzzle for humanity. When you mentioned earlier that your survey shows lots of people think they know what dogs want and are trying to signal, I'm certainly one of those people. Because I think of dogs as being basically comprehensible. Pussycats, whom I love just as much and are in my life more, I know when they're hungry, but other than that, I have no clue. So I'm not asking you to diagnose my domestic arrangements, Prof. Claire, but could you take us through a bit of what is going on in animals' anthropomorphism and mediated encounters in terms of when animals look, feel, speak, and think? Because for many people, the experience of this will either be so-called domestic animals, their own enslaved animals, they could be known as, or David Attenborough style documentaries.
So the book centers on anthropomorphism because what's very interesting to me is that this is sort of pitched as something that we should avoid at all costs. And actually, it doesn't matter which field you're in, which discipline, even within animal studies and critical animal studies, anthropomorphism has been, I'm going to say, a little bit of a dirty word. And good reason for that. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was to demonstrate and to actually put together a different kind of model that thinks about anthropomorphism in a different way. So one of the things that I did was to instead look at it as either this huge monolithic thing that just exists out there, which is dreadful and we should all avoid, or as other people have done, they think about it in a kind of as a typology, different kinds of anthropomorphism. Instead, what I did was I said, we've got to think about anthropomorphism as situational, contextual. We can have a situation where anthropomorphism, both in its best and worst forms, can coexist at the same time. Because I think this is where probably our backgrounds or our understanding of media studies and audiences and culture really comes to the fore. Because one of the things that always struck me was that people, when they talk about the problems of anthropomorphism, they talk about the fact that we as humans, A, both misunderstand animals, and also that when we are becoming, if you like, kind of familiar with anthropomorphism, it's through childhood, childhood sort of cartoons and books, and then we need to shed that and we need to be objective and think rationally about our associations or our relationships with animals and sort of shed the kind of the sympathetic or empathetic connections that we have with them. And so one of the things that I wanted to look at, but just to say, but most of the time popular culture is blamed then for the this kind of this general public, which is undefined, all of a sudden just engaging in sort of casual anthropomorphism that's non-scientific, irrational, and sort of in many ways dangerous. So what I wanted to point out was actually that anthropomorphism can do a lot of different things. Yes, it can be problematic because when we anthropomorphize and we put a human framework onto other species, yes, we misinterpret what they are trying to tell us or what they're saying, and that can lead to their mistreatment. So yes, that's definitely a negative part of anthropomorphism. But on the other side, you think about how many people define or understand their association with animals or come to like have a relationship with animals partly through popular culture, so maybe through the children's books that they've read or through books that they've read as a as an adult, or they may sort of have their thoughts, their ideals, their values shaped by the kind of media that they encounter. And actually, what I try and do is I try and give lots of examples in that book of the places where anthropomorphism is problematic, and then the places where actually what it does is it enables our empathetic response, and it enables us to have new often sort of interesting and creative associations with other species in ways that we couldn't necessarily do if we didn't have those particular media forms. So it kind of moves through then all of the, if you like, the big problems that people have with anthropomorphism. So the idea that and this in a way is sort of odd, the idea that animals don't speak, and somehow this distinguishes humans from animals. We have language, they do not. Well, of course, that's a very long debate to have about what we think of as language in the first place. But of course, animals communicate. Yes, of course they do. So in part, it was about sort of going through and using different media case studies and different case studies from culture that sort of explore those questions around where and how animals think, how they communicate. And yeah, just sort of, what I was trying to do was point out that actually anthropomorphism can both exist in these positive and negative senses at the same time, and actually that's okay. It's okay that happens, because what we can't do and what we shouldn't do, and particularly in light of where we are now, and specifically when we're thinking about climate change and how we communicate, to people, and we talk about climate change as well as talking to them about, the horrendous conditions that, animals that are raised, for food production, the treatment that they have on a daily basis. When we're trying to communicate all of those things, if we lose anthropomorphism from that, if you like, that toolkit of communicative strategies, I think that we're doing ourselves a disservice. And so I think that anthropomorphism is an incredibly important part of how we communicate, how we tell stories. It's actually embedded anyway in the way in which we tell stories, because we naturally assign motivation and a particular psychology to objects and animals and, and people, just as a way of telling a story and composing a narrative that makes sense to us. So anthropomorphism is at the root of our communication anyway as human beings. I think try and avoid anthropomorphism, and it's a very odd kind of language that you'll end up speaking. Even scientists, the hard from the hard scientists, they struggle to avoid using what they see as anthropomorphic statements, and ascribing intention to maybe, objects or, natural phenomena. So it's there, it's just embedded in the way that we talk, about others,
That was,
whatever the others
I
might
think I
be.
can hear somebody in the background seeking to communicate something.
Yes, that's one of my canine companions, yes, in the background there, letting me know that there's somebody around. Apologies.
No, not at all. I think it's wonderful. It's part of life. And the whole ethos of this podcast is that as much as possible, it's artisanal rather than heavily produced. And I do appreciate that, not least because I am certainly guilty of anthropomorphism. And I've always thought this is some sort of crime on my part. And you've made me feel as though it's probably almost inevitable.
It is inevitable. And see, the fact that you say straight away, I'm guilty of anthropomorphism, this is the thing that we say, and we shouldn't be thinking in that way. I do think we have to still critique anthropomorphism where it impacts negatively on the lives of animals and others. Yes, absolutely, we should be critiquing it, and we should be drawing attention to it, and we should be trying to make changes. But we also have to recognize that we can't just eradicate anthropomorphism. And actually, what we need to do, and I would say, if we're concerned about animals, climate change, any of these big issues that are, I would say, concerns to me, and I know you, Toby, at the moment, we have to accept that not only is anthropomorphism part of the way that, that we speak anyway, it's a fantastic tool to communicate and to draw on people's kind of empathetic responses. I don't mean them in a manipulative way. I know it can be seen in that way, but actually just to communicate people so that they can understand. Because how can we make sense? How do we make sense of a world that isn't us? That isn't human and it doesn't speak human. We have to put it into sort of human terms so that we can make sense of it. So I think that it's a really important tool that we need to use. And that's one of the points that I make. But as you say, it was great because it gives me an opportunity to talk about the things that I am really concerned about. And obviously, media and culture is absolutely at the heart of that, hence the title. It's about mediated encounters, which I make the point that a mediated encounter is very, very different to an in-person or a real life encounter with another person or another being or another animal.
And Prof, we're at the end of our time, but I wonder if before we say goodbye, there's something we haven't touched on in your work which you'd like to mention, or something we have touched on which you'd like to elaborate a bit further.
Oh gosh. I think, like, thank you so much for letting me have the opportunity to talk for so long about the dogs issue, which is something that I am deeply sort of
Yeah.
concerned with at the moment, and something that, is particularly interesting to me. I mean, at the moment, one of the things that I am looking at, and I've started thinking about much more is around the ways in which we can include animals in our research, but in a way that is ethical and a way that understands that they have agency and autonomy. And so I'm actually developing a project at the moment, which is around dog walking. And I'm looking at issues around agency, canine agency, and consent at the moment. So, I must say, I've just got a new book which is just out at the moment, which looks very good, by Erin Jones, which is called Constructing Canine Consent. I'm very much looking forward to reading that. It only came out the other day, and so I'm looking forward to reading that. But yeah, so I'm looking at the moment around issues around consent, and I'm quite I've been sort of looking at ways in which I can include the dogs that I live with, my canine companions, in my research as co-producers of knowledge. So that's one of the things that I'm sort of grappling with at the moment. There's quite a bit of work out there on it already, this sort of work. So I'm trying to find my way through and negotiate my way through that at the
Well,
moment.
just remind them they'll only get tenure if they publish in properly indexed journals, okay?
It's a timely reminder, thank you.
Well, our four-legged friends need guidance in their careers too.
Of
So,
course,
Dr.
yes,
Hawkinson, thank
absolutely.
you so much. In the years we've known one another, I've enjoyed our infrequent but always profound encounters, and I'm a huge fan of your work, so this was a great opportunity for me. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And can I just return the compliment and say, of course, I'm a huge fan of your work as well. And again, thank you so much for the marvelous chapter that you contributed to our upcoming our book that's coming out soon. Thanks so much, Toby. I really appreciate it. It's been lovely to chat to you.